According to the New York Times, we're in the midst of a great cultural identity migration, previewing iconic American figures, popular sitcoms, and Hollywood blockbusters. The author wonders if this new shift is actually the latest phase of a recycled conflict, one that is part of our DNA. As Jewish communal leaders, certainly, we understand what it means to operate daily within that tense space. Our speaker today says that this cultural identity shift poses a great challenge to legacy Jewish organizations, especially when combined with general trends towards decentralization. What does this mean for Jewish communal leadership? How can federations find new ways to compete in the marketplace of ideas and institutions? To help guide us, we are fortunate to have the president of the Shalom Hartman Institute of North America, Dr. Yehuda Kurtzer. Oh. And don't forget, you can play the GA and win a trip to Israel. It's a message from your sponsor. Download the app now. Turn on your Bluetooth and earn points by checking into each session and taking a survey after. The survey will appear in the session description on the app once our session is over. Got questions? Our help desk has answers, so get in the game. And thank you. And here is Dr. Yehuda Kurtzer. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, there's your answer to the future of Jewish communal organizations, more apps. It's wonderful to have a full room here at the GA, especially for what it is that I want to do today, which is sometimes feels a little bit countercultural to these types of communal gatherings. Can you hear me okay? Yes, good. Which is to primarily be here to ask some difficult questions, create an environment in which we can think a little bit together about those questions and ultimately try to constitute a little bit of a Beit Midrash, a study room, around these questions and the way in which our tradition has thought about them in the past, with the hope that some of that language becomes useful for us in the present in thinking about a set of questions that are both new and a little bit old. So over the summer, I wrote a piece in E-Jewish Philanthropy right in the height of the drama that was beginning to play out in many federations around the country in trying to deal with whether the federation should or should not take a stance in response to the Iran deal. I wrote this piece. I felt at the time it was a little bit risky, and I was incredibly gratified by the response that I heard from so many professionals and lay leaders within the system that they actually felt an urgent need to surface the underlying anxieties and considerations around that decision, as opposed to merely allowing the issue to be a partisan conflict between those who would support and those who would oppose the deal. And I'm particularly grateful to Jerry Silverman, who asked me to participate in this type of work, and to Gail Zucker for her work in organizing the session today. The question I want to ask today, what I asked in that piece over the summer was, can federations continue to be, and my hypothesis was no, can federations continue to be convening organizations if they're also advocacy organizations? Inevitably, if your goal is to be able to convene a community around a complicated issue, if your goal is to lead a conversation around a complicated issue, then the decision to take a political stance with respect to that issue is going to undermine your ability to convene long term. And that we were at a moment of an identity crisis. Do our central communal organizations want to be convening organizations, or do they want to be advocacy organizations? Now, I implicitly took the position of we should remain convening organizations, even though functionally it's actually a big open question. It's perfectly legitimate, for instance, for a communal organization to decide, since we can't and no longer want to speak for the entirety of the people, let's speak on behalf of those who identify with our positions. But I want to ask a little bit of a more lateral question to that today, which I think underlies a lot of these issues, and goes to the question of what leadership should look like, or what leadership consists of, in light of the larger and bigger issue that we're struggling with right now. Sorry, I'm getting some feedback. Are you all getting some feedback? Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, better? Any better? There's a bug in the sound system that whenever you say Iran deal, that happens. The question I want to ask today, and I want us to learn together about, is basically this. What does leadership in Jewish life look like, especially for communal organizations like the Federation system, when the authority of those leaders, or the authority of the community's leaders, is no longer self-evident? Now, I'm not sure that leadership in Jewish history was ever really self-evident, and certainly there have been dissidents, people who stood against the community's leadership throughout our history. But what we're living through, especially over the past 20 or 30 years, with a whole set of trends in terms of belonging and membership in communal life, is that more than ever, our community organizations like Federation want to speak on behalf of a community, oftentimes claim to speak on behalf of a community, but they are operating with a base, a membership, who no longer sees themselves as captive to that leadership. Now, you all know this. If you're involved at all in fundraising, and were involved a generation ago in fundraising in the Federation world, the idea that people would think of themselves as operating within a tax structure, which was once much more true of the American Jewish community, that I owed my taxes as a Jew in a community to the Federation, is completely gone. And instead, federations, if they're going to compete for dollars, do so on the basis of, are they offering something competitive in the marketplace relative to any other philanthropy or cause that people might choose to give to? That shift, that pivot, suggests that the relationship between the people who see themselves as the leaders of the community and those who ostensibly belong to that community has moved from one of inherent belonging to what we might call competitive belonging. What do I need to do? What do I need to say? What do I need to offer to make you feel that you're a part of me? In other words, membership no longer can be taken for granted. What does it mean for the individuals who seek to lead a community when they can no longer take for granted? And particularly when it comes to federations, if you have to compete in the marketplace at the same time that you're trying to define, own, and lead that marketplace, those objectives oftentimes feel that they're at odds with each other. In other words, federations try on one hand to say, how do we speak on behalf of an incredibly complex community, which can turn into a very banal set of ideas, if ultimately you're trying to create a broad consensus on very complicated issues. Right? So on one hand, you want to say something important that gets people to be a part of your community. On the other hand, the more precise and more specific you offer your position with respect to a political issue or a social issue, you necessarily close off the ability to speak on behalf of the whole. The idea that I want to share today, which we're going to learn together, is as follows. Leadership today, in virtually every sector of Jewish life, is fundamentally and constantly a transacted activity. If leadership once meant, I have a positional authority over others and they are captive as members to my community, leadership now means, what do I need to be constantly doing and transacting with those who I seek to lead in order to keep them part of the structure in which I'm leading? The more that I misplay that transaction of leadership, the less likely they will see themselves as subject to my leadership. And what does that do then to institutions like federations, which once upon a time may have thought of themselves as inherently in charge of a community's agenda and now must see themselves as transactionally responsible for a community's agenda? I would posit, I don't know the political breakdown of every federation in the country, but I would posit that there is no federation in America that didn't have people who left the community as a result of a decision one way or another with respect to the federation's policy on the Iran deal. That meant people left because the federation supported the deal, people left because the federation opposed the deal, and people left because the federation wouldn't take a position on the deal. What that means is, again, instead of being angry at your leadership, but staying to fight, which suggests that you see yourselves as belonging regardless of what happens, people see themselves as operating within a space in which leadership is being transacted. If the leadership expresses a position that supports my views, I will see myself as beholden to that institution. If the leadership decides not to support my views, I am no longer beholden to that institution. I will take my dollars, my interest, and my support somewhere else. I want to take that question, that position for granted. And if we wanted to today, we could talk about all of the historical and social and political reasons that we've gotten to this place. By and large, by the way, this is good news. American Jews are comfortable enough as people who belong to America that their need to belong to a privatized Jewish version of America has diminished. This is by and large a good story. But it does force a set of questions for us as leaders, as institutions in this community to ask, how are we going to rebuild a notion of leadership over a community in which our authority is being constantly transacted? If we can no longer take for granted that we are in charge and therefore can shape an agenda, how do we continue to lead rather than become completely subservient and beholden to the people who we serve? I want to do this by taking a case study from history. If you look at the source sheets that are in front of you, I think there should be enough. They should be on all the tables, but if not, we can pass some from the front back to the back. I'm not going to read the piece that I actually quoted from my own article, but I want to put it there just as data to what the prompt was for this session. In particular, and it was quoted before in the outset, that all of our institutions are forced to compete differently in this marketplace of ideas and institutions. I want to suggest a case study from Jewish history, and then I want to do some study together that helps us wrestle with this. And the case study from Jewish history says as follows. In the wake of the destruction of the temple in the year 70 CE, there emerged a vacuum of political leadership in the Jewish community. And we know this from any intro to Jewish history class, that when the temple gets destroyed, Jews no longer see themselves as capable of organizing their Jewish life around the temple, right? Now, I know very little about science, but stay with me for a second. If the temple served as a gravitational force, and so much energy and attention was directed towards that gravitational force, what happens when you explode something that's at the center of a gravitational force? What gets created? Black hole, right? That is true, right? What happens then physically or spiritually or emotionally to all of those people who feel held, controlled, and defined in terms of their identity by what was once a gravitational force? They could get sucked into the black hole. They could get spun out because of the absence of a gravitational force. And the historian Seth Schwartz, a professor at Columbia, offers a very provocative thesis that I want to try to play with today. What Seth Schwartz suggests is it took about 4 or 5 centuries until the Jewish people figured out what would be the new structure of authority that ultimately would replace the temple in Jewish life. Usually, in our Hebrew school version of Jewish history, we say the temple got destroyed and the rabbis stepped in to fill the void. Schwartz says actually it took several centuries before the people figured out who was ultimately going to be authoritative in Jewish life. What this means then is that a group of individuals begin at a moment in Jewish history as marginal, as competitors for the authority over the people. And because of what they do for several centuries, they transact authority such that 600-700 years later, they wind up being in charge of the Jewish people. The reason I want to use this as a metaphor for today is because there are a lot of indicators that we are living in a post-authority moment for Jewish life. There are a lot of indicators. The culture of philanthropy has been transformed. That's the Gary Tobin study from now 10, 15 years ago, that more money exists in private family philanthropy than exists in the Federation system. A dramatic shift. We're living in a post-authority environment for all sorts of other reasons. The rise of the innovation sector, the belief that instead of putting my money in the community chest or defining my agenda through the community agenda, I will create my own organization to serve my needs. All of these are markers, and the Iran deal and the instability of the Iran deal is another indicator that we're living in an environment in which authority can no longer be taken for granted. And if we're going to wind up seeing a reacquisition of authority by people like those who are in this room, who see themselves as responsible for the community and want to be able to use that sense of responsibility to lead, it's going to have to happen through a transaction of authority, exercising it in ways that people want to buy into our authority, and then turning that into systems and structures that make people buy in when it's no longer taken for granted. This is the metaphor that I want to play with. And to do this, I would like you to study in Chavruta, and I'll give you some instructions on this, five models from rabbinic tradition for how the rabbis acquired their own authority. Again, I want you to take for granted that because the rabbis see themselves as in charge, it doesn't mean that they actually are. True then, and perhaps true now. What Schwartz basically argues is that some 5-6 centuries after the temple gets destroyed, because of the things that the rabbis did over 5 or 6 centuries, they emerged as authoritative. And I want to use that as a metaphor for thinking about how we, people who care about leading Jewish life, can acquire authority through transacting it. So I want to give you 5 models to do so, which are on your sources. If you want to read the background materials and the case study, you can. But the 5 models are, number 1, authority is acquired based on the position that you hold and the coercion of other people into your position. This is the most common way that people think about authority. You have to obey me because I am in charge. I want you to look at 1 or 2 sources from that set. A second type of authority is I'm going to coerce you to obey my authority, but ultimately you're going to agree. And you're going to suspend your resistance to be part of what I'm leading. A third form of authority is you try to win over the hearts and minds of your people. A fourth is you establish precedent, sometimes by subterfuge, and therefore wind up seizing power by undercutting other people. And the fifth, could there be an ethics and openness approach to acquiring authority? As you might discern, I like the 5th model more than the other models, but we'll talk about and unpack what it means to hold all of these simultaneously. What I'd like you to do as follows for the next 20 to 25 minutes. I'd like to either work with your whole table or to identify 1 or 2 other people who you're going to study with. If you've not done Chavruta before, or even if you have, the goal is not to get stuck in the text, at least for the purpose of this exercise. The goal is to have a conversation about leadership, authority, and communal life through which these texts serve as metaphor or a prism in order to have a contemporary conversation. If you're getting stuck in the old texts and you want to talk about federations, that's fine. I'm giving you permission to do that. I'd like you to read the text out loud to each other. If you don't know what it says, don't know what it means, try reading it out loud a second time. And the third time, you may just want to start talking about what you think the big ideas that are trying to be conveyed here. The goal is to have a conversation using the frameworks of these texts so that when we come back together, we can put a set of big ideas on the table and see whether A, the tradition helps us think about those big ideas, and B, more importantly, do those big ideas help us in this moment to think about how to lead our communities. So we'll take about 20 to 25 minutes and go. What I want to do is as follows. I know some of you got through, I saw all 5 sections, some of you didn't. What I want to do is offer some thoughts on why these sections are here and what the main ideas are meant to convey, and then we'll open up to questions, comments, and discussion about the applicability of this thinking and this model. And then we'll try, can you hear me back? Can you hear me now? No? Yes? Better? Okay. And then we'll try to wrap up with some applicability of this type of thinking for the present reality and the leadership and authority that federations are trying to lead with. Now, in all 5 of them, as I hope you discerned, whether you got through all 5 or just 1, each of them imagines a different exercise of leadership or an attempt to exercise leadership. And each of them imagines that the source of authority that's being adduced by the leaders in this moment comes from a different place. That's what's different about all of them, is that each of them imagines that its source of authority is different. And what I want to do together is not just figure out what is that source of authority, but to ask what are the strengths and weaknesses of each of those claims to authority. And I hope that in doing this, you'll find familiar some of these adducing of sources of authority to leaders who you know or institutions that you know. We're not going to name names. But the goal is to try to figure out why, in some cases, that appeal to a certain type of authority is effective and why, in other places, it seems very dated and profoundly ineffective. The first set of sources in Model 1 we called position and coercion. The claim to authority that's being made here is in the, hold on a second. in this first text from Maimonides, that the exilarchs in Babylon, that is, the heads of the Jewish community of Babylon, function instead of the kings. They have the authority to impose their rule over the Jewish people in all places and to judge them, whether they consent to that authority or not. This is derived from Genesis 49:10. The staff will not depart from Judah. This refers to the exilarchs of Babylon. So first of all, this is actually a very radical text. The idea that the Jewish people were once led by kings who had came from the Davidic line, and that that same line gets carried over to a group of leaders who travel to Babylonia is actually kind of a subversive idea. You would think that once the monarchy is over, then those guys who are leading the Jewish community in Babylon don't function underneath the same prism of authority. But Maimonides says, no, they function with the same authority as kings. So what's the appeal, what's the source of the authority of these leaders of the diaspora Jewish community? The Bible and continuity, right? As long as you can make a claim that your authority stems from an older version of authority that you've inherited, you remain authoritative. This might be summarized differently as some people are in charge because of tradition. My parents were in charge. Right? I come from the right line of people, or perhaps I have other criteria, other objective signals or signs of my own power, and therefore I should be in charge simply because I have that, and that signals that I am the inheritor of the rightful authority of a generation that came before. It's not always said this way. Sometimes it's said in terms of money. Sometimes it's said in terms of family lineage. Sometimes it's expressed in other ways. But it imagines that I don't have to do anything in order to acquire the authority that I want to exercise over other people. It's kind of been given to me or invested to me by larger factors that are bigger than me. I'm just one chain in a long line that's actually holding on to this power. This gets played out, if you looked at the second text from Maimonides, by the instinct of people who have this type of authority to actually be very coercive on kicking out those in their communities who stray from that path. If your power derives from some intrinsic sense of your own authority, because of the Bible or because of your wealth or for any other reason, then people who deviate from how you want to lead the community, you're going to want to actually kick them out. If they don't see themselves as subordinate or subservient to your form of leadership, you're going to be very inclined to push them out. In other words, the leaders in our, and we know this, the leaders in our community who are most inclined to the identity politics of insiders and outsiders are those who have no claim to their own authority except through position or tradition or lineage, right? Because they don't have to make a credible argument on why they're in charge. They know that they're in charge. And anyone who's going to make a counter-credible argument needs to be shoved out or moved away because that's actually deeply threatening and destabilizing to the leadership that they're trying to exercise. Maimonides, in the third text that I gave you, takes this even further and suggests that it doesn't mean that those individuals necessarily carry their authority from one place to the next. They don't speak on behalf of all of the Jewish people, but that they are the rightful inheritors from their ancestors of this traditional line of authority as it was conveyed. So the first idea I want to throw out is that the first sourcing of authority is authority that is basically intrinsic. The Bible made me authoritative. I have the right family, I have the right last name, I have the right power. I don't have to nothing about what I do actually makes me authoritative in my community. The strength of that argument is it's at least self-evident to the leaders themselves, right? There actually is something very strong to the claim of being one in a long line and in a chain, right? The appeal to tradition has had a very compelling claim over people for a long time. The liability, of course, is number one, I can imagine all sorts of people in this room and outside of it who would say, that's nonsense. Just because you thought you were authoritative doesn't make you authoritative. But the other major liability is in the second text that I presented, which is the impulse of those who are intrinsically authoritative to be very quick to try to kick people out of that big tent. I want you to hold on to that, because this is one of these questions in a gathering like this one where we talk a lot about language of big tent, but some of the ways in which leadership is exercised, even by the same people who want to have a big tent, actually runs counter to that core value of having a big tent, because you actually can't do both. You can't assume that you have authority just because you've had it all along, and at the same time be able to make space for other people to express ideas that run counter to the value of that authority. That's idea number one. The second source of authority, coercion and consent. And the rabbis tell this great little story about the giving of the Torah, which says as follows. And the people stood at the foot of the mountain. And they pick up on the fact that in Exodus 19, when it describes that the Torah was being given at Mount Sinai, the Bible uses the phrase, tachtit ahar, which if you read it literally means they sat under the mountain. The rabbis like to find these little problems in the text because it becomes an opening for them to talk about a set of ideas or values that they can embed into the reading of the text itself. So they stood under the mountain, Rabbi Avdimi Bar Chana said. This teaches that the Holy Blessed One overturned the mountain upon them like an inverted cask and said to them, if you accept the Torah, good. If not, this will be your burying place. In other words, where does God's authority come from? Either do my will or I will kill you. Right? A kind of continuation of the first model of authority. I'm in charge. If you don't listen to my authority, you can leave, or in this case, be dead. And therefore, the Israelites only accepted the Torah because they were under duress. Now, the reason why this moves us to a little bit of a different place is because the rabbis are aware, even as they tell the story, of the fundamental problem with this own theory, which would be, does that mean that we're only obligated to follow God's authority because he forced us to? They know the problem, right? It's a cute story, and they know the problem. The key part comes in the second sentence, where they say, Rabbi Acha ben Jacob observed, this makes for a strong protest against the Torah. If Torah is only obligated on us because God forced us to, maybe it's not that good. And therefore, it says as follows, said Rabbah, even so they accepted it in the days of Ahasuerus in the Purim story, for it is written, they confirmed and took upon themselves, they confirmed what they had accepted long ago. Right near the end of the story, once Haman and his sons are dead, and so people have kind of spaced out in the reading of the Haman story because you don't have anybody shaking the groggers anymore, at one point in that story, it describes the Jewish people living in different provinces accepting upon themselves the observance of the Purim laws. Now, this is a very inside baseball move here by the rabbis, because in the book of Esther is the one biblical story in which God's name doesn't appear. So when it says that the Jewish people took upon themselves, accepted upon themselves a form of law, and God hadn't instructed them, what they're using that to say is, later on in Jewish history, even though at one time we were given the Torah by God and coerced to do it, at later times in Jewish history, we accept voluntarily that covenant without it being coerced. Follow that? I'll say it in kind of the secular terms that we're talking about. Maybe once upon a time, we were only subject to the authority of the Torah because we were forced to. But every time we willingly accept the authority of the Torah, we've now given consent, which makes the original giving of the Torah no longer coercive. So what might be the source of authority that we're thinking about in this context? As long as I get the consent of the people, it's not coercive, even if it kind of is coercive. Right? So I decide to do something and to lead a community with an iron fist, but I create mechanisms by which the community assents or agrees to the leadership that I've attempted to coerce on them. And as long as I do that periodically and I signal that they are actually agreeing to my leadership, my authority is kind of coming from the people, even if it originates from me. I see some people nodding, some people shaking their heads. I suspect both the people who are nodding and those who are shaking their heads are doing so because you know people who operate like this. So I want you to hold on to that a little bit. The strength of this argument is that it makes for a very strong leader, because a person who has coercive authority over others is intrinsically very strong. The weakness of, and the other strength of it, is that it is aware that unlike Model 1, I can't simply coerce and never ask whether you like it. It's aware that it actually has to be cultivating the agreement of the people who are being led. But the weakness is, like the first model we looked at, is that any coercive model begins to dissipate and feel not only unethical, there's something unethical about this form of leadership, the idea that we would actually be coercing our people to follow us, but it also becomes less and less likely when people don't see themselves as subject to your own authority. Right? Is it imaginable 30, 40 years down the line that either of these coercive or position-based models are going to be able to speak for any percentage of the Jewish people in America? Let's look at the third model, I think my favorite. Hearts and Minds. This is an obscure little text from the Talmud Yerushalmi, which describes as follows. In the days of Rabbi Yochanan, they, that is the people, began to make images on the walls of synagogues, and he didn't stop them. In the days of Rabbi Abun, they began to make images of mosaics, and he didn't stop them. So why would he have stopped them? In theory, because drawing pictures in a synagogue should be a violation of the second commandment. According to a straight reading of the Bible, you shouldn't have figurative art in synagogues because it looks idolatrous. But what happens? The people start doing that. And what does Rabbi Yochanan do in his benevolence? He doesn't stop them. Now you could read this positively or you could read it cynically. Positively is he sees that this is a trend of the people, he's already in charge, and he tells them, I want to honor the needs of my people and allow them to do the things that they want to do. In Jewish community parlance, this is called meeting the people where they are. This will appear many times at conferences like this. Instead of dictating to people what we want, how do we listen to them about what they want and then give them permission to do that? The cynical reading of the text, which is embedded even in what I just said, is they don't care whether you give them permission. Your only authority derives from the fact that you're allowing them to do the things that they would want to do anyway. So Rabbi Yochanan, by this reading, only becomes authoritative because he's allowing the people to do the things that they already want to do. It's the most social contract-based form of authority. Every rabbi in America will tell you that this is the way in which their employment works. Right? There are many stories. Congregations hire rabbis to do the things that the congregation wants them to do. The more that the rabbi pushes his or her own agenda on the people, be it political or religious or behavioral, the congregation will say, well, let's just look for another rabbi. Our institutions are designed that way. So the third model here is authority is only based on the permissive culture that the authority figures get from the people or grant to the people. Don't give the people what they want. Not only the only thing that will happen is they will find another authority figure who will do what they want. And so what would be the way to lead in this environment? To just be a great listener. To follow the will of the people and make possible the version of what they want to have happen in order to stay with your position intact. The fourth model I gave you is a cute little story that the rabbis tell from Mishnah Rosh Hashanah, which describes a problem of post the destruction of the temple, should you be allowed to blow the shofar in your local synagogues? On one hand, the shofar is associated with the temple. Should we be able to do it in local synagogues? Are we violating the authority of the temple? Are we going to allow people to blow shofar on Shabbat? Don't really know. The rabbis then tell the story in source B, Babylonian Talmud, Rosh Hashanah 29b, on page 5. Our rabbis taught, once Rosh Hashanah fell out on Shabbat, and everybody gathered together, not sure what was supposed to happen. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to the Betharians, a group of people who kind of are always on the losing side of arguments, they're like the Washington generals of the Talmud. People know that reference? You know, the guys who always lose to the Harlem Globetrotters, yes? Okay, let's blow shofar, he said to them. They said to him, let's discuss. This, by the way, should be most familiar to anyone who's worked in a communal agency. Somebody wants to do something, and the first answer is, send it to committee. Right? So he says, I want to do this. I think it's important. The time is right. Their answer is, send it to committee. He said, OK, let's blow shofar because the time is now. And then we'll send it to committee. Then we'll discuss it. So they say, OK. After they blew the shofar, they said to him, OK, now let's talk about it. He said to them, the horn has already been sounded in Yavne, which he means literally and figuratively. We blew the horn, but also, like, you know how we use that for the Jewish National Fund is also called Keren Kayemet, right? This is a Keren, meaning we've already established precedent, and we don't reverse after the deed is done. In other words, wah, wah. Right, once we did this, this is now the normative policy, and this is, we know this form of leadership and authority. If you act first without asking questions later, it's much harder to reverse what actually happened because of that sensibility we've created precedent. This is, by the way, in Jewish camp form, this is known as the always never rule. People know the always never rule? If on the first Shabbat in camp, you give out ice cream Shabbat afternoon, on the second Shabbat in camp, we always get ice cream on Shabbat afternoon. However, and the reverse is also true, this is true in communal life as well. We always hold this event on the second Sunday in May. Or the leadership always first goes through a stage of being in young leadership cabinet before they get a seat around the board table. That's how we do it. We always do it that way. And once I've established these norms, my authority comes from having stepped out and done things at a particular time in a particular moment, which makes it very hard to undo it. Now, again, there's strengths and weaknesses here. The strength of this is that don't you once in a while want to have a leader who acts like this, who instead of constantly saying, let's wait until all of our membership has bought in, or let's wait until it goes through all of the channels. There's something appealing about the decisive leadership that's being exercised by Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai here, of the willingness to say, no, I'm not going to wait till I go to a full vote of all of the trustees of this federation before I make a decision about the Iran deal. This is urgent, and it's important, and it requires my leadership, and people are going to have to get in line. There's something appealing about that. And even if you don't like the Iran example, think of a different example. You sometimes want somebody to say, I don't want to wait to talk about this, I just want to make this decision happen. Of course, the flip side to it is, number one, that's a lot of trust in a particular individual, right? And oftentimes this is that trust is misused. Number two, what if the people rebel against that kind of leader, which they're inclined to do because the way in which he, in this case, but could be a she in any case, is exercising leadership invites a kind of instability of the more you do this, the less likely the people are to trust any process that you initiate. You can get away with this once. You can't really get away with it as a perpetual model. And the fifth model that I gave to you, which I called Ethics and Openness, I want to read both of these texts. The first is as follows. At the end of the persecution, our teachers gathered in Usha, and these are they, Rabbi Judah, Rabbi Nehemiah, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Rabbi Eliezer, son of Yossi the Galilean, and Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. They said to the elders of the Galilee, saying, whoever has learned, let him come and teach. Whoever has not learned, let him come and learn. They gathered and learned and took care of all of their needs. Where does the authority come from for how these guys are trying to reconstitute Judaism in the wake of a catastrophe? The authority comes from people showing up. All you do is open the doors and tell people to come. And so how do you create authority? Be the types of people who are actually radically willing to open up the table for participation and belonging. Look how dramatically different that story is than the first model that we looked at. In the first model of authority, the central characters are authoritative because they said so. And anyone else who doesn't fit into that model of authority gets jettisoned. In this model of authority, these rabbis are only authoritative because they actually express the kind of vulnerability of we open up the doors and whoever comes in is essentially belonging to the community. This has the strength of feeling very democratic. There's something very modern and contemporary about this. The liability of it is that it's really scary. Imagine if you really constituted community based on who actually showed up. That's actually nerve-wracking if you know who shows up. But B, are you really willing to let go of the ideological parameters of belonging that actually have defined community for a long time? The final text I'll look at, and then I see some questions and comments, and I want to take them. The final text describes a famous text on the long debate between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. And of course, the text tells us that the teaching is according to Beit Hillel. But I want to look at the last line, which says, "Since, however, both are the words of the living God, what was it that entitled Beit Hillel to have the law fixed in agreement with their rulings? Because they were kindly and modest, they studied their own rulings and those of Beit Shammai, and were even so humble as to mention the actions of Beit Shammai before theirs." The radical idea of this text is what grants authority to one compelling vision for Jewish life or another is the one that acts nicer. And those who act nicer actually make a more compelling claim to actually have authority over the others than the reverse. This is actually a really subversive idea, right? And it actually, you know, we're challenged right now where many Jewish institutions and organizations are actually being made to look like the bad guy because their doors are closed, right? Because they are creating very clear ideological parameters of what people can say, think, or believe in the context of their institutions. And as a result, they look closed when other institutions look open. So I set out here five different ideas in terms of the sourcing of authority, kind of from one extreme to the other, from assumed authority at the beginning, which is inclined to create identity politics, all the way to open authority at the end. I want to offer two closing comments, then I'll take some questions. Number one, all leaders at various times or others in all institutions are probably going to play with all of these. Right? Part of the game, it's not about picking, I want to exercise my authority this way exclusively and not any others. At various decision points, institutions and leaders are going to have to think with different sources of authority at different times. And depending on the issue, you may act like a Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai one day, and you may act like the synagogue mosaic guy on a different day. Where I think our leadership is running aground is when people get so stuck in one particular model that to every, you know, it's what's that expression? To a person with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, right? That is essentially what's playing out. We have certain old visions of authoritative leadership that are translating into mapping that form of leadership onto everything else. And when that happens, it looks so dated, and it looks so uninteresting, and it winds up actually driving people away. The core takeaway I want us to think about is, number one, are we picking our spots as communal agency and as individual leaders correctly to know when we're looking at a B situation or an E situation? And the second is, are we actually exercising our muscles as leaders and as institutions to understand what are the full demands of each of these positions? It's not enough to say, well, this is nice, but I know that I'm really a Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai shofar guy. That's how I operate. I think part of what's so amazing about the rabbis here is that you take these as a composite, and they tell the story of how a group of people went from being marginal people to being in charge of Judaism. Because they managed to figure out where were the spots in which they were going to act like this, and where were the spots in which they were going to act like this. This is, for us, a little bit of a thought experiment. If we're at a moment now, like these classical rabbis, where we're only in charge of our people to the extent that we make a compelling case to be in charge of our people, can we try out pluralistic modes of leading and exercising authority that make a compelling case that we are in dialogue with and receptive to the changing trends in Jewish life, as opposed to playing out a vision of Jewish leadership that now feels really dated? Let me stop there and take some questions and comments. And there are some microphones on both sides if you want to go there. Actually. Go ahead.
I just had a question about the
Yeah, say your name.
I'm Carla Goldman from Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan. Just a question about the second to last example, which was about coming to the table as a student or a teacher. I was wondering if there wasn't a hierarchy of learning there, an authority that comes with learning or study or with knowledge.
So something beautiful about this text, which is, if you're a teacher, come as a teacher, and if you're a learner, come as a learner. So there is a preservation of some authority, and part of the way that you're only going to make this model work is if people who already have authority feel that they're respected in that context. But then in the second half of the sentence, it says, they all gathered and they all become learners. It doesn't say they gathered, they taught and learned. Once you actually get people to buy into that, then everybody ultimately transforms themselves into learners. One of the main obstacles to getting to Model 5 in Jewish community is that one generation of leaders feels disrespected because they feel that they're not going to be treated with the authority they deserve or with the respect that they deserve. And the other generation comes at it and also feels disrespected because they don't feel that ultimately in that process they're going to be listened to. But what's powerful about this is open the doors. You give some people the credibility and the respect that comes with the authority that they've inherited, but once you actually have people in the room, you let the chips fall where they may, and everybody, whether teacher or learner, becomes transformed into part of building community. Yeah.
Actually, looking at the same source, we talk a lot about Midrash. These stories sometimes are things that happened, and sometimes they're things that theoretically happened. And what smacks of fantasy to me here is this final line of, they gathered, they learned, and then they took care of all the needs. And I think we all agree that theoretically, we'd love to see consensus-oriented models. I think realistically, one would have to question the efficacy and what's really effective about, you know, governing by fiat is you don't get stuck in quagmire, which is, I think, I'm Shuli from UJ Federation of New York, and one of the many criticisms of Federation is that we get stuck in that quagmire all the time by trying to serve all the people.
So I think it's a fair question of, is this a fantasy that they actually took care of all of their needs, right? That they opened the doors, allowed people to kind of self-select to be part of those, they were going to serve those who actually came in their doors. I think all five of these are fantasies, right? All of these are visions or imaginations of where does authority come from, what does leadership look like, and what do we see can work. It's possible that, to your point, there are issues around which this can't be made possible, right? I'm in the catchment area of UJA Federation of New York, and I have to say I was very actually moved by the approach that UJA Federation took, which felt to me very Model 5 here during the buildup of the Iran deal, which was, we're going to essentially make the discussion in the New York Jewish community a Beit Midrash on the Iran deal. And so you had these five events and speakers who spoke in favor of the deal, and these five events and speakers that spoke against the Iran deal was probably more than five on each side. And here are the contexts and spaces in which we're going to think about this. The consequence is that the composite of those who were engaging with the Iran deal was a community, because you could enter in with a strongly held view one way or another, and you were listened to and heard, because your people were speaking in Federation. And if you were on the other side, the fact that somebody else was taking a position that was different than yours didn't make you feel left out. I think the challenge with Model 5 is not, is it a fantasy that it could never work? It's that we don't really try it all that often. And that maybe part of the issue here is that we're so nervous about it feeling so lofty, because there's an exciting ethical vision of what community can look like. We're so anxious about the fact that it's going to fail that we don't actually push in that direction. Part of what I'm trying to argue for is, if you go back to the outset of this talk, the old model doesn't work anymore. People don't buy into the leadership of Federation just because, you know, they have the building and they have people's names on the wall and because their parents and grandparents gave to Federation last generation. They may want to belong to the extent that they're made to feel as though their belonging means something. But if that's going to happen, we got to play a lot more in this, what feels like lofty Model 5, even if it feels like, as a complete and comprehensive story for leadership and authority, it may feel naive. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
Hi, Justin Pines. I'm a Wexner Graduate Fellow and Yeshivat Chovevei Torah rabbinical student. So, Justin Pines from Yeshivat Chovevei Torah and a Wexner graduate student, graduate fellow. So, I want to also kind of focus on the second part of example five, because that's what really spoke to me. It seems, first of all, just thinking about the different examples, that's the example that seemed to have had the most at stake in some ways. It was kind of like all of the law, which is what the Talmud is trying to figure out. Sorry.
You have to speak into the mic, yeah.
I'll speak. Is this better?
Yes.
Sorry about that. Thank you for helping me. I was saying that, thank you. I think of the examples, the second example of part five, the conflict between Hillel and Shammai, the two houses, in some ways that's also the example where the most is at stake, because they're deciding basically generally the law, which way it will go. This is like Democrats versus Republicans, the massive debate. And in that case, it's decided by that fifth model, which is about ethics, not necessarily even openness, ethics. We go with the Hillel side because of how they approach the discussion. They share, Shammai said, first, they're nice. And I think by kind of drawing attention to that element is what really speaks to me in a lot of ways. Because when we think of things that don't seem to work, like, I think we're so far past the, we have to focus on what we have to get done, instead of the, how do we get things done? What are the ethics that we bring to the conversation? I think stepping back and trying to be like, well, what does it mean as an org to be ethical as an org in the way we interact within, internally or externally, and that being a priority that gives authority something that speaks to me.
Yeah. And it's in essence the most, even though it's the most appealing, it also feels like the most risky. Right. Imagine if, right, we genuinely valued and evaluated the qualities of leadership, and we granted authority to those who had the most expansive visions. Doesn't mean that Beit Hillel didn't have strong opinions of where they thought Beit Shammai was wrong on a certain set of issues. They actually had vicious debates throughout the Talmud on their substantive issue. But what if we were evaluating them not on the basis of their lineage or their background or even the effectiveness of their argument, but evaluating and awarding leadership in our community on the basis of the people who actually acted with the most expansive and ethical sensibility? We don't do it because we tend to think that Yochanan ben Zakkai, who does that trick with the shofar, is a more effective leader. But actually, this text is at least making a claim that part of that conversation has to be how leaders lead, right, in the fullest, most ethically lofty type of way, as opposed to simply the effectiveness argument that that oftentimes wins the day. Yes.
I'm Judy Kupchin. I don't know if this is working. I'm with the Florence Melton School. And I want to compliment you on a beautiful session, that your own subversive methodology here today was to teach us text as a way of entering into this very compelling and profound subject about leadership. So I want to suggest that Dafka, the study of Jewish text, is what empowers all of us people to have a voice. And the more knowledgeable we are about our tradition and the more conversant we are in these kinds of texts, the more likely we are to enter into the conversation and not just follow our leaders because they tell us that's the way to go. So, kol hakavod.
Thank you. And I'll conclude and thank you all. I want to just, I have a vision and a hope that sessions like these move from being breakout sessions to the main sessions, right? Imagine if all of our gatherings and convenings in Jewish life were defined by this intersection between an urgent issue we have to deal with, a need to create space in which everybody is a little bit of a teacher and a little bit of a learner, and an awareness that even though there are issues of tremendous urgency, that if we don't become learners in that process, as opposed to performers in that process, we don't feel as committed as stakeholders as we need to be in order to get to the solutions. So thank you, everybody.